President of the United States, on his way home to the nation's capital from Warm Springs, Georgia, pauses at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill to address the Carolina Political Union and to receive the honorary degree of Doctor of Laws from the university. Chapel Hill, under a dull, leaden sky, today observes a triple occasion: a general convocation of the University of North Carolina, the commemoration of the third anniversary of the founding of the Carolina Political Union, and the address of the President of the United States. The Carolina Political Union is a nonpartisan organization controlled and operated by a group of 25 students at the University of North Carolina. It brings to the campus outstanding representatives of varying political and social viewpoints. The red, white, and blue bunting blends with the blue and white colors of the university in this woolen gymnasium as the audience of 6,000 focuses its attention on the platform where the president, in the academic robes, will soon receive the purple hood symbolic of a Doctor of Laws degree. Mr. Voight Gilmore, chairman of the Carolina Political Union, which is a nonpartisan student organization, will open the program. Mr. Gilmore.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, and fellow students, the Carolina Political Union, a nonpartisan group organized to hear and study all sides of political and social issues, today, in celebrating its third anniversary, welcomes the many thousands of adults and particularly the thousands of students assembled in Little Chapel Hill to hear our president. The Carolina Political Union treasures the privilege of free expression of opinion at this, the oldest state university, which has enabled it to bring a representative of practically every social and political creed to our young people. Such free discussion of issues is vital in any true democracy. And so today, we greet the leader of free discussion in America. May I introduce at this time the chairman of the Board of Trustees of the university and the able and beloved governor of North Carolina.
Mr. Chairman, I am much gratified to see today this vast throng of representative North Carolinians who've come to do honor to our distinguished guest. Mr. President, in behalf of these and of all the men and all the women and all the children of North Carolina, we welcome you within our borders and to this seat of learning, this ancient and honorable university. Measured by all the standards... Measured by all the standards of useful service, of worthwhile accomplishments, and of acknowledged leadership, we hail you, Mr. President, as the first citizen of the world. I now recognize R.B. House, Dean of Administration of the University of North Carolina.
Mr. President of the University of North Carolina, on behalf of the faculty, I present for the degree of Doctor of Laws, the President of the United States.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the University of North Carolina, welcomes you not only as the leader of the people of America, boldly groping for a way out of economic depressions, but also as the leader of the people of the world, valiantly hoping for a way forward from democratic retreat and international despair. Through your leadership, the voice and ideals of America are counting on the side of oppressed minorities and disinherited majorities. The America for which you gallantly speak, inclusive of factions and parties, stands for the freedom of open and wide discussion of all issues and a fair hearing to all sides. for the ways of peace and democracy rather than of war and dictatorship. For a new hope to youth and a more equal educational opportunity to all the children in all the states. For the right to honest work, whether in private industry or on public works. For humane nationwide minimum standards of hours, wages, and conditions of fair competition in justice to workers and businessmen. For money as the medium of exchange rather than as the master of labor and enterprise. For the saving of our soils, minerals, forests, and water power. For the security of banks, farms, industries, and homes. For farmers as equal partners in our economic society. For the advancement of American democracy by more equality of bargaining power through the organization of workers, the cooperation of farmers, and the information of consumers. For social security against old age, unemployment, sickness, and the hazards of modern society. And for intelligent production as a way of abundance and decent consumption as a way of life. And for a more abundant distribution of the good life for all people in the eternal adventure toward the kingdom of God. In appreciation of the democratic faith and the humane hopes your American leadership gives to the people of the world in this time of crisis and bewilderment, the University of North Carolina, by the vote of the faculty and the trustees, confers upon you the degree of Doctor of Laws. And gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Governor Hoy, President Graham, my hosts of the Carolina Political Union, my newfound alumni of the University of North Carolina. From the bottom of my heart, I am grateful to all of you today, very happy to be a part of this great university. A very old friend of mine, the late Mr. Justice Cardozo, of the Supreme Court of the United States, said this the other day. We live in a world of change. If a body of law were in existence, adequate for the civilization of today, it could not meet the demands of tomorrow. Society is inconstant. So long as it is inconstant, there can be no constancy in law. Law defines a relation, not always between fixed points, but often between points of varying position. There is change, whether we will it or not. And it is recognition of that philosophy that has made the University of North Carolina representative of liberal teaching and liberal thought. And it is my recognition of your recognition of that philosophy that brings me so willingly to Chapel Hill today. It is a far cry from the days of my first visit to the university, nearly a quarter of a century ago. And the splendid new buildings that I saw in the last 5 minutes of my drive prove it. I came here then because my old chief, that consistent North Carolina liberal, Josephus Daniels, told me that I should see for myself a great institution of learning that was thinking and acting in terms of today and tomorrow, and not merely in the tradition of yesterday. In those days, 1913 and 1914, the leadership of the nation was in the hands of a great president who was seeking to recover for our social system ground that had been lost under his conservative predecessor, and to restore something of the fighting liberal spirit which the nation had gained under Theodore Roosevelt. It seemed one of our great national tragedies that just when Woodrow Wilson was beginning to accomplish definite improvements in the living standards of America, the World War not only interrupted his course, but laid the foundation for 12 years of retrogression. I say this advisedly because it is not progress, but the reverse, when a nation goes through the madness of the 20s, piling up paper profits, hatching all manner of speculations, and coming inevitably to the day when the bubble bursts. It is only the unthinking liberals of this world who see nothing but tragedy in the slowing up or temporary stopping of liberal progress. It is only the unthinking conservatives who rejoice down in their hearts when a social or economic reform fails to be 100% successful. And it is only the possessors of headline mentality that exaggerate or distort the true objectives of those in this nation, whether they be the president of the University of North Carolina or the President of the United States, who, with Mr. Justice Cardozo, admit the fact of change and seek to guide into right channels that change to the greater glory of God and the greater good of mankind. You undergraduates, and possibly some of you graduates who see me for the first time, have read in your newspapers and heard on the air that I was, at the very least, an ogre. A consorter with communists, a destroyer of the rich, a breaker of our ancient traditions. Some of you may think of me, perhaps, as the original inventor of the economic royalist, of the wicked utilities, of the money changers in the temple. You may have heard for 6 years that I was about to plunge the nation into war, that you and your little brothers would be sent to the bloody fields of battle in Europe, that I was driving the nation into bankruptcy, and that I breakfasted every morning on a dish of grilled millionaire. Actually, I am an exceedingly mild-mannered person. A practitioner of peace, both domestic and foreign. A believer in the capitalistic system. And for my breakfast, a devotee of scrambled eggs. You have read that as a result of the balloting last November, the liberal forces in the United States are on their way to the cemetery. Yet I ask you to remember that liberal forces in the United States have often been killed and buried, with the inevitable result that in short order, they have come to life again with more strength than they had before. It is also true that other men in public life have protested in the past against certain forms of economic control, and that epithets far stronger than any I have ever used have been employed even by presidents of the United States. Those of us who knew Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt and Grover Cleveland could hardly call any of them mollycoddles. I was reading a letter of Theodore Roosevelt the other day, written to a friend in the spring of 1908. And it will, I think, interest and amuse you if I quote from it. He was writing to a man who was fighting in the cause of social and political decency out on the Pacific coast. And here's what he said. Now and then you must feel downhearted when you see men guilty of the most atrocious crimes who, for some cause or other, succeed in escaping punishment. And especially when you see men of wealth, of high business, and in a sense of high social standing banded together against you. My dear sir, I want you to feel that your experience is simply the experience of all of us who are engaged in this fight. There is no form of slander and wicked falsehood in which the New York papers, not only those representing the lowest type of demagogy, but those representing the interests that call themselves preeminently conservative, preeminently cultured, have not indulged in as regards myself. From all that I can gather, the feeling against me, not only in Wall Street, not only in the business houses of the greatest financiers of New York, but also in most of the uptown clubs, it is just in these places that the feeling against me has been most bitter. As a matter of fact, I do not care a snap of my finger about it. I do not care whether they think well of me or think ill of me, but I do care a very great deal to do this work without flinching, on the one hand, and on the other without becoming angered or irritated to a degree that will in any way cause me to lose my head. Now, so it is with you and your associates. You must keep reasonably good-natured. But above all things, you must not lose heart. And you must battle on valiantly, no matter what the biggest businessmen may say, no matter what the mob may say, no matter what may be said by that element which chooses to regard itself as socially the highest element. You are in a fight for plain decency, for the plain democracy of the plain people who believe in honesty and in fair dealing between man and man. Do not get disheartened and keep up the fight. Sincerely yours, Theodore Roosevelt. born of an old New York family, Southern on his mother's side, trained as a young man on our Western frontiers, was perhaps the first American president in modern times who knew the whole nation. In the letter which I have read, and with this national background, it seems to me what he said in effect was first that the American people have and must have a definite objective for the improvement of government, for the improvement of social and economic conditions. Secondly, that these objectives must be carried out by definite action. And third, that in the attaining of them, the president and the government and the people as a whole must have essential qualities, a sense of proportion, a sense of perspective, goodwill, and last but not least, a sense of humor. Almost every crisis in the history of our nation since 1789 has become a crisis because of a lack on the part of leaders or on the part of the people themselves or both, a lack of some of those essentials. The very birth of the Democratic Party, at a time when President Washington publicly expressed the hope that the nation could be run without parties, was due to the simple fact that the government itself was dominated by the great commercial and shipping interests of the seaboard, that it failed to give recognition to the needs, to the desires of the masses of the inhabitants of the original 13 states who did not subscribe to their theory that birth, wealth, or political position could give to the possessors of these qualifications the sole right to govern. Hence, the Democratic Party. And a generation later, a government dominated by the other extreme, the plainer people from the back country, from the Piedmont and the slopes of the Alleghenies, the upper Hudson, the backwoods of New England, paying scant attention to the shipowners of the seaboard, drove our nation into the Second War with Great Britain. And here, in the South, it's worth remembering that the first suggestion of secession from the Union, was proposed by delegates from the New England states in the Hartford Convention of 1814. In both cases, tolerance, the national point of view, were absent. Another generation went by, and it was the same lack of tolerance, the same lack of a national point of view, that brought about a war which was not inevitable, the war between the states. The scene changed, and the nation was confronted not by a sectional difference, but by a struggle for economic and social control, a period which saw the control of our national government by groups of individuals who, owning their government through owning vast financial power, used the plea of development of our national resources that they might feather their own nests. In the lifetime of people who are still with us, there were men whom we must admit, had courage and vision. Men who pushed railroads across the plains, opened mines, dammed rivers, created vast aggregations of capital, and left in their wake vast aggregations of national and state and local political power. In a sense, those were glorious days, because the wide open spaces were open to to those Native Americans and those who are flocking hither from the centers of Europe to find work in new fields. A current author has recently emphasized the perfection of life that surrounded our population half a century ago. He draws a picture of the complete lack of any restraints on any individual, and he infers that every American of half a century ago, no matter what part of the country he or she lived in a utopia of work and play to which we should seek an immediate return. I don't believe it. A few days ago, in Georgia, I was talking with an old friend whom I have known for many years. He's what might be called an old-fashioned Southern conservative. We got to reminiscing about the old days when I first lived in Georgia. And he reminded me of the days when cotton was selling at 5 cents a pound. And while he admitted that the ramifications of our federal legislation, and especially of court decisions during the past 6 years, were somewhat beyond him, nevertheless, he allowed that some principle of crop control, cotton and tobacco, for example, decided on by a majority of the farmers themselves, was the most democratic way to prevent the return of 5 cent cotton in a few years. He reminded me of two little banks in Warm Springs. Banks in which many thousands of dollars of local savings had been deposited. Of the failure of both these banks and the loss of the savings. And of the fact today that deposits in the banks of the United States are safe. And he remarked, I hope that that type of liberal legislation will not be repealed. He reminded me of the white men and Negroes who never saw as the heads of families $100 in cash from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. He reminded me of the days in 1932 when the states of the Union were going broke, losing their credit because the whole burden of the relief of the starving was placed on their shoulders without the contribution of $1 from the federal government. He reminded me of the complete lack of any social security program, of the days when a home builder was charged 15% and 20% to borrow the money to build his house, of the days when slum clearance was a beautiful ideal on paper and nowhere else. And when he left me, he said, young man, I don't know the United States the way you do, but I know this section of the nation pretty well. I don't understand the working out of all these newfangled things that the government has been starting in the last 6 years. But I want to tell you that there's a new spirit abroad in the land. I am not talking just about the fact that there's more buying power, that houses are painted that were never painted before, that our banks are safe, that our roads and schools are infinitely better. What I am talking about is that all of our young people in my section of the country, and I think in every other section, our young people think that they are going places. just those two words, going places, seem to be an essential in modern civilization everywhere. They represent the conviction on the part of the young people of America that life never remains static, that there are better days ahead than ever before, that an opportunity to find a way of life, to earn a living, to raise a family in comfort and security are better today and will be better tomorrow. There may be those in the world who believe that a regimented people whose every thought and action is directed by one man or two men may give some people a type of security which is pleasing to them. But whatever convictions I have, none is stronger than my abiding belief that the security and well-being of the American people can best be served by the democratic processes that have made this country strong and great. The future, however, rests not on chance alone, not on mere conservatism, mere smugness, mere fatalism, but on the affirmative action which we take in America. What America does or fails to do in the next few years has a far greater bearing and influence on the history of the whole human race for centuries to come than most of us who are here today can ever conceive. We are not only the largest and most powerful democracy in the whole world, but many other democracies look to us for leadership in order that world democracy may survive. I am speaking not of the external policies of the United States government. They are exerted, as you know, on the side of peace, and they are exerted more strongly than ever before toward the self-preservation of democracies through the assurance of peace. What I would emphasize is the maintenance of successful democracy at home. Necessarily, democratic methods within a nation's life entail change. The kind of change through local processes within our own national borders. Processes described by Mr. Justice Cardozo. The kind of change to meet new social and economic needs through recognized processes of government. Because we live in an era of acceleration, we can no longer trust to the evolution of future decades to meet these new problems. They rise before us today, and they must be met today. That is why the younger generation means so much in our current affairs. They are a part of the picture in their 20s without having to wait until they passed middle age. That is why I myself associate myself so happily and so greatly with the younger generation. And that is why I am happy and proud to become an alumnus of the University of North Carolina, typifying as it does American liberal thought through American action.
So the President of the United States concludes his address at the University of North Carolina, where is the guest of the Carolina Political Union. He spoke before a general convocation of the university. The President received the honorary degree of Doctor of Laws from Dr. Frank P. Graham, President of the University. Star Spangled Banner. paused at Chapel Hill on his way home to the nation's capital from Warm Springs, Georgia, President Roosevelt and his party resume their journey as over 6,000 of the students and alumni and guests of the university stand and shout their farewells. This broadcast originated at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, through the facilities of WJSV, Columbia Station for the nation's capital. Charles Daly speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.